Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 61 of NML Crossing, which I used to say this a lot during X-Lapsed. This one might be kind of a short one. There just really won't be a whole heck of a lot to say about the story we're about to discuss. It's not a bad story. I'm not sure I'd call it a good story. It feels kind of like filler. You know, like they had this spot, they needed a story, it's a one-off, like I said, there just won't be a whole heck of a lot to say about it. But before we get into it, I did want to thank some folks for reaching out to me today. When I came back for the previous episode, I kind of had the pre-ramble where I was talking about some of the stuff that I'm dealing with here personally, and really didn't expect to hear anything or to, you know, I'm just, you know, some idiot who's talking about Batman, basically. So I don't usually expect people to reach out or people to, care. And I tell you, it means a whole heck of a lot to me, more than I can adequately put into words. It really, really does. I think in this internet age we're in here, it's easy to forget that on the other side of a recording, there's a human being, right? And it's especially so for me because I forget that I'm a person sometimes. And it's a weird bit of dissonance, you know? I'm here to talk about comics, but unfortunately, you know, life is what it is. Life gets in the way. Life's a hurdle that needs to be jumped sometimes. And I guess what I'm trying to say is I really appreciate you guys listening to me and giving me this space to kind of delve. I know I used to really, really, really delve. That kind of became the gimmick for a bit where it was more my ramblings about life than discussing anything comic related. I'm trying to find a better balance between the two in a way that isn't too self-indulgent, but at the same time isn't me shutting myself off and just being a reciter of what happens in comics. So just thank you. Thank you all for your patience and the erratic, sometimes erratic schedule. So I really, really appreciate it. And people who reached out, I tell you, that really touched me. And there's folks who've been reaching out for the past few weeks who I very much appreciate as well. So thank you all so, so much. And I mentioned last time that I was about to take some drastic steps, and I didn't mean to alarm anybody. The drastic step I was talking about was actually seeing a psychiatrist and getting back on the medication merry-go-round, which I've been on it before and hasn't been great. And not that there's been, you know, bad side effects or anything. It's more a matter of just nothing happening. And then you talk to a provider and, they really don't give you much of a forum to speak. It's just, here, try this, here, try this, here, try this, and nothing really works for me. I don't know what it is. I'm having some gene site testing done. That is something that is going to be heading to my house pretty soon here to try to figure out what might work and what won't work, just to, you know, cancel some stuff out. And I actually saw the doc today. I was prescribed something new, which I'm kind of hopeful for. My insurance didn't want to cover any of it, which is no surprise. I've got the worst insurance in the world, but yeah, we'll see. We'll see how it goes. That was a whole kettle of fish this afternoon that I won't bore you with. I think I've bored you enough for this episode. And how about I bore you some more with the discussion of Batman, Legends of the Dark Knight, number 118 from June 1999. The story's called Balance, written by Greg Rucka, with art by Jason Pearson and James A. Hodgkins. Colors, Rob Schwaga. Letters, Albert de Guzman. Edits, Illidge, Gorfinkel, O'Neill. Cover price, $1. 1999. Now, like I said, there's not much to say about this one. We open with an extended scene of Batman busting some skulls. And it's being narrated in almost theatrical prose. And, well, there is a reason for that. It's actually a story being told to a grump, to a group of young No Man's Landers by Alfred, who appears to be tapping into his old stage persona, Alfred Beagle. Now, it's the story of a knight and his squire. Not that knight and squire, nor the other latter pair with the same name. I've been doing a lot of research on knight and squire. I mentioned some time ago that I'm trying to fully receive the Grant Morrison Batman run, which has been too, you know, over my head for a decade and a half at this point. And in order to do so, I'm trying to, like, track back all the references, doing a fake-ass annotation, you know. And, of course, there is a knight and squire there, and the whole, you know, what were they called, the Batman of the World or whatever. And, of course, there was a knight and squire back in the 50s or so that it was a reference to, so I've been trying to do my research, going through that old Batman encyclopedia and the Dark Knight, the Tales of the Dark Knight essay book, trying to get all those ducks in a row and try to figure out where everything fits. And I feel like I used to be a far better fake-ass comics historian than I currently am. Back in the old Cosmic Treadmill days, I feel like it used to come a lot easier to me for research and remembering things, where now it takes a lot. Anyway, where the hell was I? Oh yes, it's a story of a knight and his squire, not those other knights and squires. This is actually the story of Batman and Alfred and how their paths diverged and recrossed after the very bad thing that happened that night at 7:03 p.m. Now, among the kids that Alfie's entertaining is one that's kind of a douche. He thinks Alfred's story sucks, and he kind of thinks Alfred himself sucks as well. Leslie Tompkins, who organized the little performance, tells this dumb little kid to, shut up at his face. And so, Alfred jumps back into his tale. Now it begins with the squire loyally serving his knight, and residing in a tremendous castle, one that was toppled in a cataclysm. Now, this was a cataclysm that would turn the entire kingdom upside down, where lunatics would start roaming the streets and people were hurt and killed, and among the ruckus, the knight would disappear. Now, that douchey kid, Scotty, he interrupts to call the knight a loser for splitting on Gotham City, and he takes it a step further by referring to the knight as a twink, which I don't think that means what he thinks it does. Anyway, Alfred continues. The squire, now left alone, needed to figure out how to survive without relying on his knight. Now we watch as he collects some of his belongings in a backpack and leaves Wayne Manor. Back in reality, one of the children wonders where this story could possibly be going now that the knight has taken off. After all, it's not like a squire can do much of anything. It's not like he's going to be fighting or defending anyone, right? Well, we can call this kid the facilitator, since she done pushed us into the next phase of Alfred's tale, wherein he reveals that, in fact, the squire could fight, and also protect those around him, should the need arise. And so, we watch a scene play out of the man himself saving a young lady from some no-man's-land ne'er-do-well. Not sure what his designs on her may have been, but we can certainly use our imagination. It's not like he was trying to, you know, mug her of cash or anything. Anyway, not only does Alfred save the gal, he also patches up her wounds, because among his many talents and life experiences, our squire was an accomplished medic. The woman invites Alfred back to the ramshackle flophouse she and many other No Man's Landers are currently shacked up at, and they present our hero with a new coat, I think? It was the coat the woman was wearing, so maybe he's just holding it? In any event, the people applaud, and he thanks them. The story continues, now veering into another of our squire's expertises, that of being a spy. We see Alfie as he looks through some night vision goggles to check in on a gang meetup. He's also mapping out all the gang hotspots and respective turfs in No Man's Land while he awaits the return of his knight. Now that douchey kid, Scotty, he once again interrupts to inform us all about how boring this story is. And well, I hate to agree with Scotty, but he's kind of got a point. Now, Scotty, he asks if the squire ever actually does anything. Besides saving that woman's life a couple of pages ago, I guess? I don't know. Alfred continues weaving his tale. He reveals that he delivered a couple of babies and tapped into his Shakespearean stage self to perform and entertain gaggles of No Man's Landers. The kid does not care. He wants to hear about the squire getting into fights, which takes us to the next and hopefully final act of Alfred's story. We're back to Alfie the spy, watching him as he watches some gang-banging slavers. I mean, they're literally leading a group of civilians who were daisy-chained together with collars around their necks. Now, Alfred, he swoops in and manages to KO one of them with a telescoping baton, while the other slaver, like, confusedly swipes around him with his machete. Like, it's really awkward here. Alfred uses this odd distraction as an opportunity to free the slaves. It's a very messy scene. Like, if this were a video game, we'd all be making fun of the poor enemy AI here. It's like, this goofball is literally just standing, like, facing the other way, which is enough cover for Alfred to unchain all these slaves. This is like easy mode Metal Gear or something. It's really, really weird. Anyway, the big slaver finally realizes what's going on and manages to fight off the old man's baton. He also gashes our hero in the shoulder. And now, finally, young douchebag Scotty is at attention. There's action going on in the story. And just as the slaver is about to kill our squire, the knight returns. Batman swoops in and just beats the holy hell out of the baddie. And that's the end of Alfred's story. That's it. We're immediately brought back to the present, where our man thanks Leslie for inviting him to, you know, share his tale. Scotty is sitting here, he's like, hey, old man, you forgot something. You know, the ending of your story. Which, again, I hate to agree with this little turd, but he ain't wrong. To this, Alfred gets all waxy and poetic. He says that this ending wasn't an ending at all, but a beginning. Ugh. And with that, Alfred heads back home to whichever place Batman's hiding out at. They talk about their plans for the next day, which appear to involve Two-Face. And we close out our issue with a 1919 Woodrow Wilson quote, and we are out of here. Next time out, another one-off in Shadow 86. So, what did we think of this one, huh? Like I said, there ain't a whole heck of a lot to say here. This really felt like filler, and it might, unfortunately, be the first non-Asriel dud in the No Man's Land era. And I mean, I get the, I get the story. It kind of feels like it would have been more at home as a 6 or 8 pager in Chronicles than it's in, you know, own issue here of Legends. It's, I don't know, I mean, I'm a huge fan of world building. And so we do get a little bit of that here. I mean, we have the kids, we've got Leslie. It just didn't really, it just didn't really do anything for me. It was kind of a chore to read. And it was even harder to write about because, I mean, not much happens here. It's not even a whole story. Like, Alfred gets to the point where Batman comes back and it's just like, okay, see ya. that's the end of what I'm gonna tell you. Like, it almost feels like they gave up writing and drawing it. Like, it's got to the point where it's like, okay, we don't have anything else to say. Yeah, pack it and print it. We're done. Like, I would sometimes make reference back in X-Labs to where I'd say, like, it felt like a story realized they ran out of pages, you know, so it just ended. This one, like, it ended before the pages ran out. It just kind of stopped. Oh, boy. And, you know, not to put put the cart before the horse here, but we've got a couple more of these one-offs coming up, and they're all kind of weak. It's to the point where I think we've got two more one-offs coming up, and then we have two issues of Azrael, and I'm looking forward to talking about Azrael, which, I mean, what world am I in? What world am I in where I'm looking forward to talking about it? Because the Azrael stories are absolutely bat stuff insane. They're almost, at least the first issue, it's like, I almost wish this was a video podcast for that one, just to show you all this story. Because it's, it's something else. It's something else, and I'm looking forward to talking about it. But this one today, not so much. Really, not much to say. It was just kind of there. I guess we're going to get those on occasion, right? This entire story has like 100 parts to it. So we're bound to get... And I mean, it wasn't even bad. It was just kind of... it was just a dud. And, you know, probably not the last one we'll get. But outside of Azrael, it is the first. But rather than belabor the point and continue to beat the dead horse, we will just we'll stop right there. And we will hop on into our NML bag here. We got a couple of letters. First one is from our friend Ed Moore, who we were talking last episode about preferences between color and black and white as it pertains to some collected editions. Some art better lends itself to black and white, or they were originally made for black and white. Some, of course, are originally made with color, and when you take the color away, it might not be as great. It might be better. You never know. Now, Ed here is talking about Usagi Yojimbo, a series and a character who he is very, very knowledgeable of. He says, Usagi Yojimbo is an interesting subject in light of the black and white versus color question. It's in its fifth ongoing volume since 1984, and three of those volumes have been in color. The color volume's total issues are nowhere near the total issues for the black and white volumes. I consider the book to be black and white, since that's when I first started reading it. There are also several instances that, during a recent color volume, the publisher also had the rights to reprint many of Usagi's earliest books, originally dropped in black and white, now in color. This allows for a direct comparison to Sensei Sakai's black and white lines printed and redone in color. I prefer comics drawn with the intention of being reproduced in black and white. And I tell you what, I forgot all about Usagi. For Christmas one year, my family was bugging me to do the Amazon wish list thing, which to me feels like cheating. You know, it's like, it's not quite the letter to Santa, but it's, I don't know, it feels like because it is, it's me telling you what to buy me, right? So I put a bunch of my bucket list books on there, and Usagi Yojimbo is one of them. And I got volume one. It's this big, thick, you know, phone book style book. And I didn't make it very far into it. It's just another one of those books that I mean to read. And the pile grows and grows and grows. But the art in it is beautiful. It's black and white. It's spectacular work. It is really, really nice. And I don't know that I'd ever seen Usagi in color, of course, outside of the covers. But it is very, very beautiful work. Sakai always makes it look so simple. That's one thing that always aggravated me about certain artists. Like, it looks effortless, you know? And I'm sure at this point it is, but... Oh, it's just... I can't draw a straight line with a ruler. So when I see just this effortless work, it's highly respected, but also I'm very, very envious. And you know, the same Christmas where I got that book, I also asked for the Spawn Compendium from Image. And it's this, God, it must be every bit of 10 pounds. It's a huge, huge book. I think it's the first 50 issues of Spawn collected. And it's in black and white, which, you know, you don't know that that would work. Spawn, of course, was produced with color in mind. You know, Image's coloring was like way ahead of the game back in the day. So to see it without the color and see how effective it is, it really jumped out at me. McFarlane's pencils, or just the pencils and inks, I guess, without color. Phenomenal stuff. Really, really pretty stuff. It's another book that I barely got halfway into before putting it down, but it's another one of those bucket list reads, right? But that's another one I forgot all about, seeing that in black and white and color. I'm trying to think. I'd have to dig out my old Warrior magazines to see. Was V for Vendetta originally in black and white? Something tells me it was. I could be completely off my nut here, but I'm going to have to dig around in the old magazine box and try to find out, because that'd be a pretty interesting comparison as well, if I'm in fact right, which happens about a third of the time. So we'll have to see. But thank you so much, Ed, for writing in and for reminding me that I need to read that Usagi Yojimbo collection. Next up, we got our friend Eric, who's writing. We talked about a con I went to last time out, the Old Man Con, the comics only convention, which are seldom seen anywhere nowadays, I would imagine. And Eric says, I wanted to say I remember the mall cons at the Sunbet Mall as well. And wow, how about that? A fellow Long Islander. How about that? When I say Sunbet Mall, a couple of people have mentioned that they went to those mall cons as well. Tom Panarese is one. He's a prolific podcaster who I've had the pleasure of speaking to a few times. I think we grew up like 5 minutes apart. We went to the same comic store, the same conventions and stuff like that. So it's always interesting when you meet people that you probably pushed past, trying to reach Superman 75 or something, right? And since I kind of I track my life through comics, basically, so all of my nostalgic memories are heavily based in where I was when I saw or bought or read a certain comic book. So the Sunbet Mall has always been a very like bittersweet nostalgic place for me. I recently looked, I did one of those, I don't know, maybe I'm a, I know I'm a weirdo, but maybe I'm even more of a weirdo than most. You ever take like a driving tour through your old hometown, like on the Google Maps? You drop the little man on the street and then you just like inch your way through the old neighborhoods just to see what it looks like now. And I did that in order to like retrace my steps here, where me and my friends would, walk across Sunrise Highway, and we would stop at I think it was Comic World was on the corner of like Sunrise Highway and I think Ocean Avenue or Locust Avenue. It's right across from the Wall Bombs. Or here's another Long Island thing or New York thing. Do you say Wall Bombs or Wall Bounds? I say Wall Bombs. Bounds is not allowed in my house. But we used to walk up there, and we'd go to the Kmart, we'd go to the Borders Books, and then we'd continue on our way. We'd go to Nobody Beats the Wiz, and then go to the Sunbet Mall. And time, being what it is such a cruel son of a bitch, because like it's all different now. It's like Borders is gone, most of the Sunbet Mall is gone, the Wiz is gone. All the comic stores are gone except for like a couple, and I doubt any of the ones that were open back then are still open. But I remember when I was, doing my little tour here, and I came to the parking lot of the Sunbet Mall, and it looked like like post-apocalyptic. There was like nobody there. There was nothing going on. I think there was like a ramshackle photo mat in the front that like had like three walls left on it. Pretty sad. And then I found some videos of people walking the Sunbet Mall current year or relatively recent, and wow, there are like no signs of life in that place. It's really, really sad. I think like the Pathmark is even gone. That's where we used to do our weekend shopping, and that's when I would run into these little conventions every once in a while. So it's always interesting to see another Sunbet vet out there, someone who pounded that pavement just like I did. Eric continues. He says, there was a comic store in that mall that I went to all the time as a kid. I asked the owner one day when the next con was going to be, and he said it wasn't worth doing anymore and that that store would be moving out of the mall. I don't remember where the store moved to, but I never made it to its new location. And, you know, I'm trying to remember, that might be a little bit after my time. When I went there, there were no comic stores in the mall. There was a baseball card store that would sell comics. It's actually where I got one issue from the Doomsday run, the Death of Superman run, that I couldn't find at any comic shop. They'd sold out right away. And that weekend when we went food shopping, lo and behold, I find it in this baseball card store. And that's where I used to also buy my my Marvel Universe singles cards. You remember those boxes where it's like a dime a piece for all the common cards? I remember going to town trying to, because I started my Marvel trading card collection with Series 3. So everything before Series 3 looked like an ancient relic to me, you know? And I remember finding like a tiny stack of Series 2 there, and I was just over the moon. I felt like I was like holding gold. It was pretty ridiculous. Eric continues. I also only read Marvel when I was growing up. I didn't start reading DC comics until about 7 years ago. Since then, I've read everything Batman in order to get a grasp of his timeline. But going back and reading other series, it was very awkward at times how the timeline of some events played out, just like the instance of Batgirl you mentioned last episode. And that's true. I mean, I mentioned it last time out. The Batgirl special was like right before The Killing Joke. Batman Year One was right before Batman Year Two. All these like weird things I never put two and two together until I actually had them in front of me and was looking at cover dates and was like, wow. How weird is it that that everything was so rapid fire when I was used to be like knowing things inside and out, you know, like I used to be able to quote X-Men chapter and verse, you know, where nothing could really surprise me. So seeing the DC timeline post-crisis, seeing that they like literally hit the ground sprinting was interesting. It was very, very interesting. Eric continues. I found Nightwing to be confusing. I did not realize how long it took for him to get his blue and black costume as well as get his own solo series. He was only seen on Titans teams for a very long time in the 80s and 90s with very few guest appearances in the Batman family of comics. And Nightwing's an interesting one because my DC reading, like I mentioned, was very, very sparse growing up. And I remember it was part of Nightfall because, you know, everybody was buying Nightfall. And everybody was trying to get rich off of Nightfall if the 50-cent and dollar bins in my area are any indication. But I remember Nightwing shows up in one of them, and I didn't know who he was. I just thought he was like this other random DC character I knew nothing about. And I remember finding out that he was the first Robin, and I was just kind of gobsmacked because I didn't know Robin's from Robin. So when you know, Tim Drake's there, I figure that's just Robin, you know, I figure it's the same Robin as you know, same as it ever was, but in fact it was not. And I think DC, the editorial teams there, were just as confused because they were trying to get Nightwing spun off from the Titans for a long, long time. I remember doing some blog posts on Chris's on Infinite Earths. I was doing a lot of Titans stuff. And in the letters pages, like very early, relatively early on, it was like, oh yeah, Nightwing's miniseries is coming out soon. And they had the creative team there. And it was like, it's going to, you know, spin things off for Nightwing to be a solo hero. And it like just never came out. It took until, when was that awful, well not awful, but the kind of lackluster Denny O'Neil mini. Probably 96 or so, 97 perhaps. I know it took him a while, is what I'm trying to say. I think the character would have been, boy, like 60 years old before getting his own ongoing. That's pretty wild, isn't it? I want to thank Eric for writing in and for sharing some of his Sunbent Mall story with us here. If anybody's interested in the Sunbent Mall, which nobody should be. But there is or was. I have not been active on the Twitter machine in a long, long time, or at least proactively. I just share the show, and I mean, nobody sees it because I don't think anybody's even there anymore. But there was or is a Sunbet Mall parody account. And I think like the tagline is like voted Long Island's best mall 1983 or something like that. It's pretty funny stuff. I don't know if it's still active or not, but it was pretty funny. It got a few laughs out of me. But thanks again for writing in, Eric. I really, really appreciate it. And of course, if anybody out there would like to join in the conversation and hey, maybe share some of your mall con stories. And if it's a Sunbet Mall, even better. You could reach me at all those usual ways. Chris is on infiniteearth.com, chrisandreggie.podbean.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, and all the social media places as well. But I think that's going to do it for me for today. I wound up getting a lot more minutes out of this one than I expected to. How about that? Anyway, I would like to thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it